Okay, everybody, I think we will, if you could settle down, thank you. We've got just a one-hour meeting, and welcome. Good to see a very large number of you around here in the historic Shaw Library, which are surrounded by pictures of former directors of the LSC, including our last one over here, Craig Calhoun, wearing his, his braces. There we go. So here you are. It's a very historic room, this. And it's wonderful to welcome you all here, but particularly to welcome Madam Borkova to this lecture on strengthening global governance for the 21st century. I'll say very little about our speaker, because she should be very well known to you already. She's been director of UNESCO since 15th of November 2009. We like being precise. They don't tell me what time of the day, but and was successfully re-elected for a second term in 2013. And she is and remains the first woman and first person from Central Europe to lead the organisation. Congratulations, and you've been doing a great job. As Director General of UNESCO, Madam Borkova is actively engaged in international affairs to advance gender equality, quality education for all, and combat terrorist financing by preventing the illicit traffic of cultural goods. Borkova will today explore the challenges of an increasingly turbulent world and the role of the United Nations in particular and international organizations in sustaining a rules-based international order. We have to say that nothing could be more important today, given there's so many people around the world breaking those particular rules. I should just add that this is a lecture organised by LSE Ideas, which I am proudly the director, so welcome to an LSE Ideas event. Keep looking on our website and our homepage. We're doing lots of things, this being but one, but a very important one of the things we are doing. And we also are engaged increasingly, and we should have been before, but we're engaged increasingly in thinking about working with the United Nations. We already have a person working within LSE Ideas, Dr. Mary Martin, who's been working on aspects of the UN, and we're hoping to establish within Ideas a broader framework for thinking about the UN, to work with the student body in the UN especially, because I know the student body here, the student UN, is extremely active, and we are a school where there are real students in real time, and we are really, really engaged with the UN. So one of the things we're also going to do is to think very seriously about how we as a centre can work with the students and with many of the faculty around the school. And the more I've looked into it, there's so much work being done here about on the UN in various aspects of development, international law, human rights. And indeed, one of the great historians of this school, man called Charles Kingsley Webster, wrote a very interesting history of the LSE and the UN and the role of the UN and his role in particular in writing the United Nations Charter back in 1944 and 45. So there's a long relationship between the school and the UN. Housekeeping, I've got to notify you, I always forget to do this, so I'll remember today for once. Notify of the hashtag LSE Borkova. I'll also highlight that this event is live tweeted. An audience can follow at LSE Ideas and join the debate on Twitter. You won't be surprised to hear I won't be doing so. I'll ask the audience to put the phone on silence. I've just done mine so as not to disrupt the event. And to inform the audience, I've got very clear instructions here from my boss. There is the chance to put questions to the speaker following. There's more than a chance. I've already spoken to the speaker. We will leave half the time available for questions and answers halfway through, about half an hour in. So with no further ado, on behalf of the school, on behalf of LSE Ideas, I'd like to bring a great welcome to our speakers, Irene Roker, speaking on strengthening global governance for the 21st century.
Thank you very much, Professor Cox, for inviting me to this important series of events within the LSE Ideas, and of course, having it in this historic show library. I could hardly think of a better place. You just explained also the intimate link, I would say, between the London School of Economics and Political Science and also the United Nations. And this is the right place to explore global governance and what role for the United Nations system, and in this particular case, of course, for an organization like UNESCO, which is the United Nations agency that promotes cooperation within the areas of education, the sciences, culture, communication, the freedom of speech, the protection of cultural heritage, and globally, I would say, human dignity and human rights. I believe the LEC embodies what I see as the ethical role of all higher education. And this is to create, but also to share knowledge for the good of all. Rerum cognoscere causas, to know the causes of things. I would just add one line to the motto of your university: to know the causes of things in order to change them. Few universities have so shaped the way we understand the world. Few universities have so influenced debates and policy in the United Kingdom, and I would say in countries across the world. How many Nobel laureates are associated with LSE, and how many great thinkers and actors have walked these halls as students, but also as professors. The study of international relations was pioneered here by Philip Noel Baker, by Hedley Bull, by Martin White. The world's first Department of International Studies opened here in 1927, and LSE hosted the first major studies of the League of Nations of the principles of multilateral cooperation. I may say things very familiar to you, but I think it's important to remind us of where we stand, and also because I do believe London and was very closely, intimately linked with the creation, establishment of UNESCO. And now I know that many of the thinkers and politicians who were contributing to UNESCO's constitution were also very much linked to LSE. Because in 1945, London hosted another first with the creation of UNESCO. UNESCO, in fact, was created here in London 71 years ago at the Institute of Civil Engineering, presided by Miss Ellen Wilkinson, at that time Minister of Education. In fact, the idea of creating such an organization emerged already during the Second World War in 1942, when the United Kingdom started to organize regular conferences of allied ministers of education. And I always find this very inspiring. These conferences gathered ministers from governments in exile and countries under occupation at a time when the war was far from won. Nonetheless, despite everything, in the very midst of a conflict, for United Kingdom to promote cooperation in education as a force for lasting peace was so visionary, I would say was so brave. UNESCO's constitution opens with memorable lines. Since wars begin in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be constructed. Today, of course, we say women, men and women. This is partly inspired by Prime Minister Clement Attlee, long associated with the LSE. In new times, in new century, I believe this vision have never rung so true. Hard power is not enough for peace. We need soft power. We need education, freedom of expression, intercultural dialogue. And you, Professor Cox, in an article in 2012, wrote, "We live not just in interesting times, but in extraordinary times." And I fully agree. These are times of extraordinary change. Globalization, deepening exchanges, and technological revolution are opening vast new opportunities for trade, for cooperation, for dialogue, for human progress, for combating pandemics, diseases, for alleviating poverty, I would say eliminating extreme poverty, and tackling the challenges of climate change. But at the same time, we live in an increasingly fragmented world. I mentioned climate change, and it affects all societies. We know that poverty remains deep, revealing sharp inequalities in and between countries. Conflicts are enduring, tearing at the fabric of societies, causing humanitarian tragedies, spreading violence, hatred, and extremism. We have seen devastating terrorist attacks in Paris, in Brussels, in Tunisia, in Indonesia, Turkey, Iraq, in Mali, in Burkina Faso. We see violent extremism challenging societies everywhere. Humanity's cultural heritage and diversity are attacked. World heritage sites are destroyed to eradicate the message of tolerance and dialogue in the cultural dialogue they embody. Minorities are threatened and persecuted. And the world is facing the most important refugee and displacement crisis of our time. An estimated 1.5 billion people today live in regions affected by conflict. 40% of them are young people. 28 million young girls and boys are out of school only in these conflict areas. And 73 million people, young people, are unemployed. Now, more than ever before, freedom, our understanding of freedom, is under threat. Freedom of choice, freedom of movement, freedom of speech. And at the same time, the family of states continue to grow, along with the list of fragile countries where weak institutions, conflict, and poverty create volatile blends. This comes at the time when the role of non-state actors has never been so visible, including human rights organizations and also, unfortunately, organized crime. In this context, the very notion of power is changing. As Moises Naim put it, power is easier to get, harder to use, and easier to lose. And I think in this we should be quite clear, in my view. The world is not safe when inequalities increase, when extreme poverty remains so deeply prevalent. The future is not secure when so many people lack access to education and health, and societies are not sustainable where women still do not enjoy equal rights, when young people are jobless and desperate. We talk about global governance, but we should speak about our cities and neighborhoods, our communities, where also we must learn to live together again. I believe this setting raises indeed hard questions. Questions about the relevance of institutions created in another century. Questions about the ability of the international system to tackle threats that seem perversely designed to resist collective public action. And we hear analysts speak of a G0 world without global leadership. We hear international organizations compared to dinosaurs, at best able to do just good enough. And people point to continuing conflict and humanitarian tragedy that we see, unfortunately, in Syria, but not only, because we should not forget that Africa is the continent still with the highest number of refugees and displaced people, throwing a shadow over our efforts to achieve international peace and security. I do take these claims, but I think we need to look at global governance from the right angle, in light of the rising demand I see everywhere for global action. And I think the right angle is that of individual women and men, their quest for rights and dignity, their struggle for empowerment. The right angle is that of the women I met recently in Kabul, in Afghanistan, just at the end of May when I went there to look at some of the literacy projects that UNESCO has. In fact, we have our biggest literacy project, and also assist President Ghani to reintroduce in schools history and the notion of diversity in a country where they have forgotten that their nation has always been diverse, that their nation is a heritage of layers of civilization, and this is exactly what they have lost in the conflict, and this is exactly when I think rightfully the president thinks that without it there won't be peace and reconciliation in the country. And when I met these women, some were older, some were younger, as young as you, and all of them had babies and toddlers. And they were talking about the literacy classes. And they shared with me their thirst for learning to enhance health for their families, for their children, hygiene, to negotiate in the marketplace, to make a living with the support of their communities and husbands. And I think the right angle is that of the children and young parents also. I did meet at the camp in Iraq near Erbil, Baharka camp, where we were constructing schools, when they gave me drawings of the dreams they had for a better future. And what I saw in these drawings, unfortunately, at the background, they were, on all of them, were just guns. So they were drawings of homes, they were drawings of schools, and I think this is where we have to build on our quest for future action. So from this angle, I believe the demand for rights and dignity, for peace nowadays, is boundless. I think it is stronger than ever, because it is not given, it is not attained. And from this angle, once again, for women and men everywhere, the complexity of challenges calls for more United Nations, for more response from the United Nations, for more multilateralism, for more diplomacy. And I think there are good examples of the United Nations delivering. Of course, I'm talking about the historic agreements achieved in 2015, last year, the Agenda for Sustainable Development 2030, and the Paris Climate Agreement. The Agenda 2030 for Sustainable Development builds on the previous efforts on the Millennium Development Goals, but embodies a totally different set of new global transformative agenda for people, for peace, for prosperity, and for the planet for the next 15 years. Unlike the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals, which were almost given, imposed, in the good sense of the word, to member states, the 2030 agenda is owned by the countries. It was elaborated, adopted, with their participation. And it is interesting to recall that 2015 marked the 200th anniversary of the Congress of Vienna, which laid to rest the turbulence that followed the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. 1815 and 200 years have passed. The contrast could not be greater with last year's agreements, in terms of the number and nature of actors, in terms of scale, in terms of ambitions. But I still think that we have to know history, we have to take lessons from history in order to understand also what happens today. But we have to look for the future. And I think this is precisely where Agenda 2030 and the Paris Agreement should be seen as a very different form of multilateral action, which is truly universal and comprehensive. These agreements were reached because they were led in a process owned by everybody, by the states, by the civil society, by academia, and with a very strong participation of the private sector. They were conducted on the principle of inclusion, allowing all voices to be heard. It was about inclusion, it was about openness, and about ownership. These agreements, we should not forget, were struck thanks to diplomacy, thanks to the will of governments, thanks to the leadership of the United Nations, and I wish to highlight the role of the Secretary General, who played a vital, I would say, vital contribution to their attainment. And all this shows the thirst that exists for multilateral diplomacy today. And I firmly believe that the United Nations remains the only platform where new ideas can be transformed into norms, where new agendas for collective action can be framed on a universal basis. I see this as the new multilateralism for the 21st century. It is complex, it is multi-layered, it crosses all borders, it reaches beyond governments, and this is precisely why it can succeed. The challenge now, of course, is to make it work. And this is where I say it with the full conviction of a director general of one of the agencies, one of the specialized agencies of the United Nations, being part of the United Nations family, that was very intimately, closely involved with this work. Because if we look at the Agenda 2030, my organization has direct relevance to 9 of the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, and I would say beyond, if we also include Goal 16 about inclusive societies, about the rule of law, about strengthening of the institutions. And I think this is where we are focusing now to make this challenge work. Of course, this requires adaptation by the United Nations. It requires innovation, new partnerships, new openness with the civil society, with the private sector, with the academia. And I see here, in this regard, several areas for renewed global action. The first is the renewed commitment by all to the core goal of the United Nations Charter, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. This same objective stands at the heart of our UNESCO Constitution. I believe this calls for a new focus on prevention and mediation. We need a stronger culture of prevention across all parts of the United Nations system, for stronger early warning, stronger monitoring capabilities, notably of human rights and human rights violations. At the time when globalization is pushing identities to the front line, this means advancing new forms of dialogue and living together in ever more diverse societies. And I think you are not surprised that I am putting such an emphasis coming from UNESCO, and our key part of our work is to act for intercultural dialogue, to make the most of diversity, while strengthening respect for human rights and human dignity. I would like to take up here the rising challenge of violent extremism, which I see as a new global struggle for the hearts and minds, especially young hearts and minds. And I believe we all agree, violent extremists are not born. They are made. They are fuel. This is a process we must disarm by tackling a threat that is driven by exclusive visions of the world based on false interpretation of history and faith spinning on hatred. And I'm convinced this must start on the benches of schools, through new forms of education, through media literacy, through new opportunities for youth. Violent extremism can be countered by hard power, but it must be prevented through the soft power of education, culture, human rights. This is UNESCO's contribution to the United Nations Secretary General Plan of Action to prevent violent extremism and the United Nations global counter-terrorism strategy. And this was also my message to the Leaders' Summit on Countering ISIL and Violent Extremism last year, when I was invited by United States President Barack Obama to make the contribution of UNESCO. This is why UNESCO is acting to teach the history of the Holocaust and other genocides, to fight hatred, discrimination, and anti-Semitism today. Just 1 year ago, UNESCO held the first ever high-level conference on education to prevent and counter violent extremism, bringing ministers of education together from across the world. And just a few months ago, we launched the Teacher's Guide on Countering Violent Extremism and Youth Radicalization. In September, we held the International Conference on the Prevention of Violent Extremism Through Education with the Mahatma Gandhi Institute of Education for Peace and Sustainable Development in New Delhi to explore UNESCO's draft guide for policymakers on prevention of violent extremism through education. And this, of course, is prevention, but we must look also at peace building, and it also starts on the benches of schools. This must also include nurturing the internet for human rights and peace to counter hate propaganda seeking to lure and radicalize. Last year, we held the first also ever International Conference on Youth and the Internet, Fighting Radicalization and Extremism. And we will hold a second such conference, a follow-up, at the end of this month in Canada. We must bolster media literacy skills for young people to give them tools to make the most of the internet for peace and intercultural dialogue. These goals underpins the Unite for Heritage campaign I launched in Baghdad, in the University of Baghdad last year, with the Iraqi students to counter hate propaganda, to engage young women and men in protecting humanity's heritage. Violent extremists promote fear and division. We must respond with skills and competencies for critical thinking, opportunities for civic engagement, competencies for intercultural dialogue. Violent extremists preach exclusion and hatred. We must teach human rights, tolerance, and solidarity. I see this as the new frontline today in conflict situations, in refugee camps, in societies across the world. I believe we need also a new focus on building resilient societies. This, I understand, and this is the way I understand the core objective of the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. And the key here is inclusion. Exclusion breeds hatred and violence, weakening societies, leaving them unable to build on the potential of all citizens. Inclusion and equal opportunities make societies stronger, more united, more resilient. This is why the 2030 Agenda is such a shift, because it is founded on education, on skills, on empowerment of women, especially girls. This is how people can adapt to the unexpected, plan ahead, and recover from crisis. This is the vision that guides our UNESCO's networks of Mediterranean Youth Project, supported by the European Union in 10 countries across the Mediterranean to nurture the civic engagement of young women and men. And this is why we are so strong in investing in education for young internally displaced persons, in refugees, in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Jordan. We simply cannot afford to lose a generation in this region. I believe this calls for a new approach to peace building, for peace support that is both legitimate and effective. Let me commend in this respect also several reports that were issued by the United Nations. I'm talking about, of course, about the report on the peace operations, report on the peace building, and I would say another extremely important assessment that the United Nations are making. It is the famous Resolution 1325 on women and peace, the role of women in peace and conflict. Because I believe all of these reports, all of these assessments testify to the fact that peace operations cannot be limited to just keeping the peace. We must prevent conflicts and halt their recurrence, relapses. We must sustain peace. And I think one of the most important ideas that is emerging within this analysis, within this extremely interesting debate, is how to sustain peace and how to achieve rebuilding and reconciliation and a longer-term development. We do believe that peace support operations must be built into political and mediation strategies. I think they must be well-resourced, they have to have targeted mandates, exit planning, and also to implement in full the Resolution 1325 on women and peace and women in conflict. Women should take a much bigger part. We must connect the dots between the humanitarian peace building and development efforts. And this is where I believe, after the World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul, we within the United Nations system are moving very strong. And of course, it is my belief that education and culture must be built deeply into a single chain of action, from humanitarian efforts and peace building to long-term development support. There must be a single continuum of coherent, effective action. And as I mentioned, Afghanistan, where I was last May, and I saw for myself the link between peace and development, between inclusion and sustainability. And I did mention our major program, largest education program, in fact, in the history of the country, which is targeting 600,000 citizens, most of them women, of giving them literacy and then follow up with skills, as well as a specific target group, which is the Afghan police, which we believe is vital for peace, as at the beginning of the program, 70% of the Afghan police were illiterate. So that is why I think we have to put the dots together, speaking about education, speaking about culture. And let me, at the end of my presentation, mention why protection of cultural heritage is important to be integrated also in stabilization operations. And I would, of course, mention Mali. With the local communities, we have rebuilt the mausoleums in Timbuktu, destroyed by violent extremists in 2012. And we did so because this is essential to peace building, to rebuilding the social fabrics, and the same idea guides our work in other conflict situations. And because I mentioned Mali, and I've been there twice. I went the first time with the French President François Hollande. It was just 10 days after the French and international troops pushed away the extremists, and we were standing in front of the destroyed mausoleums, and I saw the emotion in the local communities, and I promised to rebuild them. I went 2 years later when we rebuilt the 14 mausoleums, and I was standing in front of the same communities. And I saw not only the joy, but I had the feeling that I have given them back their identity. And they were telling me that without it, they were not even thinking about reconciliation and about rebuilding the lives of their communities. So this, I believe, is also the global governance for the 21st century. And I would like once again to thank your university, to thank the debate, and at the very end, to say something that, in the words of Karl Popper, also a long-time professor at LSE, made a mark on a lot of the debate, the political debate of his time, when he was saying it is not his possession of knowledge of irrefutable truth that makes the man of science, but his persistence and recklessly critical quest for truth. I believe the same persistence, the same recklessly critical quest is required nowadays to keep improving global governance. And this task can never be finished once and for all. It is rather a process of constant adjustment, refinement, debate, critical thinking, and I would say questioning. I think this is what we are doing with you right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those inspiring words. On the question of women, I should point out to all the people in this audience, and maybe you know this, but I know because I'm writing a history of the LSE. The LSE wouldn't be here if it wasn't for one woman who's in a picture behind us. Her name is Beatrice Webb. And this library, by the way, just in case you think it's named after George Bernard Shaw, it isn't. It was his wife, Charlotte Payne Townsend, an Irish millionairess, who had the idea of creating the Shaw Library. So neither the LSE nor this wonderful room here would be here but for women. So I think your emphasis there is absolutely wonderful. I would also like to make one other point on, you mentioned peace many times, obviously, and correctly. The LSE is proud to be holder so far of two peace prizes. Philip Norbaker, whom you mentioned, who was the first professor of international relations here in the 1920s, who went on to do extraordinary work in the early stages of Israel's formation, and a man called Ralph Bunche, who many of you may know, a wonderful African-American who came to study here in the 1930s under Malinowski, the great anthropologist, and then was awarded that in 1950. But I'm also pleased to say an LSE alum has also just been awarded the Peace Prize, President Santos. He was here as a student, and we're absolutely delighted for that. Anyway, enough about history, but it is an important part of the traditions which you yourself emphasise, Maribova. And so what I'm going to do now, we've got our communications, LSE communications is already to rock. We've got about 25 good minutes in front of us. Who would like to set the ball rolling by asking the first question? Come on. You're at the LSE. There's a lady over here, so why don't we start? Perhaps you could stand up so we can see better. Thank you. Hello.
My name is Ursula Jones. I'm quite enjoying your talk, and I'm glad you're here at the LSE. One thing you said, though, is about poverty. For me, I believe that if December 2015, I sent a check to David Cameron for £366, because this is 366 days in this year. David Cameron left office and he didn't reply. Theresa May came to office, so I sent a check for £366 again. The checks came back instantly, the checks say eradicating poverty worldwide, and my check would be just because of the United Kingdom only, for the United Kingdom. The first check I sent to Theresa May came back fast, said, this office does not accept money. I said, okay. But the person who worked
Do you have a question?
Quickly.
Sorry.
The person who worked that didn't sign the name properly. So I sent another check to Theresa May, and I sent that check. And then she sent back a letter with the same check cross again, and now she said, what would it be?
All right.
But I'm one of the leaders of the United Nations, because I'm Mrs. Bass at the UN. She was looking at it, so perhaps it might come to that later on.
Okay, that's great. There wasn't a question. Maybe you might like to send the checks to the LSE. You might. Give it to the lady here to see.
It wouldn't belong to anyone.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. You must have a lot of big checkbook. There's a question here, and there's a question here. Why don't we take two together? So one here, the lady here, and the person, the woman there, and the chap there. So start with you, please. Thank you. Hi.
It's a pleasure to have you at the LSE.
Use the mic. Talk clearly into the mic.
Pleasure to have you at the LSE and speaking with LSE Ideas, firstly. I was wondering if I could pick up on some of your comments about attacks on cultural heritage and rising violent extremism. I was wondering if you could comment on your take on the effectiveness of the current framework protecting cultural heritage in armed conflict, and particularly how effective you think it is in influencing the behaviour of non-state armed groups, if you wanted to focus perhaps on Syria or Mali, the Free Syrian Army, ISIS. Thank you.
Thanks very much. That's one question. We'll take two together. Gentlemen, yeah, please.
Thank you very much for the speech. Just a question with regards to UNESCO's work with national governments. What are the main challenges that you found working with national governments? Has there been resistance to this idea of broader global governance? And how has that resistance been resolved?
Okay, so why don't we start off with those? You know, you do it from there if you like. Or you stand up.
The first question about poverty, you'll excuse me if I don't follow that much the UK debate, I really apologize. but I think, of course, I did mention in my presentation also the rising inequalities. And we know that in the last years there are a profusion of studies. I'm speaking about the World Bank, IMF, and even I remember a couple of years ago in Davos, which is the big meeting of the private sector mostly, I was surprised that inequalities were the focus of the discussions there. And it's no secret that, unfortunately, the inequalities are rising in the world. We see a changing economy. It's a whole new, of course, debate about the changing economy, loss of jobs. We see growth in some of the biggest economies, but no jobs. Of course, new jobs are creating. It's a total transformation of societies. And that is why we know that the Agenda 2030 is about eliminating extreme poverty, but we're speaking about countries in the least developed countries in the world where poverty is enduring. At the same time, we know that in the many developed countries also inequalities are rising, and that is why we insist on the changing role of education. We insist very much on the changing role, the link between jobs and education. We insist in some cases of introducing a technical vocational training. We insist on a much more elaborate way of doing education, because I believe education is one of those tools for social mobility and also for eliminating poverty in this. Of course, in any society, governments have many more instruments to tackle poverty, but I'm looking from the eyes, of course, of education. Now, the question about the attacks on heritage, I think you really put the finger in where we think the new challenge is today. Because when we see the destruction of heritage, we do not speak anymore of collateral damage during a conflict, interstate conflict. On one side, we see a deliberate destruction of heritage, a deliberate imposition of only one exclusive vision of the world, and I think extremists are targeting heritage precisely because it brings a message. It brings a message either about diversity of different cultures, it brings a message about the dialogue that existed, it brings a message also about some lessons from history, it brings a message of aesthetics, of beauty. So there are different reasons, but in any case, this world heritage delegitimizes them. That's why they want to destroy it. And on the other side, how to protect it? And I think this is the biggest question that stands in front of us. Of course, we have the conventions. We have the normative framework with the World Heritage Convention. We have the conventions of the humanitarian law, the Hague Convention of 1954. But we see nowadays that some of these conventions cannot be applied because of these non-state actors. Now, on one side, I would say what we are doing, we are trying to find new ways of approaching communities and people in order to pass the message of why heritage matters. I can cite here a new work that we have started in March. I signed an agreement with the International Red Cross because the International Red Cross are humanitarian. They're talking to everybody, all actors. They go in different places so that they could also include in some of their missions the necessity to protect heritage, to talk to the people, to talk to the communities, even the warring parties. And I think the results are extremely encouraging, what we hear as a feedback. Or we are partnering with some of the big non-governmental organizations. We established a very interesting partnership with the Swiss NGO, one of those big humanitarian Swiss NGOs, which is called Appel de Genève. They work in the warring, they try to bring together warring parts. They have done wonderful work in Colombia. They're working in the Kurdistan, in other places, once again with the same message. And of course, we try to be a bit more innovative, to link both illicit trafficking of objects of art, to give a different perspective of why, as we call them, to stop the blood antiquities, why it matters in order to cut the channels of financing and the demand side. And from that point of view, I think we have done probably most of our work. We have seen in more than 35 countries changing of legislation, establishing a new processes, procedures of illicit trafficking. We have encouraged strongly the European Union, and now they're in the process of adopting possibly a new common legislation, because the European Union and all the countries, I think, including the United Kingdom, all European countries are very strong in protecting the exports. They're very strong in protecting their heritage. And we want to be as strong also in the imports and to have a better coordination. So this is a very important part of our work. And of course, I can speak more and more. I don't want to be too much into this question. Now, the national governments and the resistance. Well, I would say that, of course, governments are governments and they have their national agendas. But I think what is the positive side of the story is that when they're within the international setting, like within UNESCO, they assume responsibilities. And our, I think, the biggest responsibility we have and the biggest influence and contribution is that we're universal and that we can convince governments to take responsibilities. First, because they have a peer review, they hold accountable each other. We have established such a structure for literacy, for example, among the 9 biggest countries in the world that have the most of the 500 million illiterate people. And we make them accountable, sharing experiences, good practices, and being accountable among each other. We made all countries last year to report to us on their achievement of the Education for All program, to present to us national reports. We hold them accountable now on the illicit trafficking. We make advocacy for them to ratify conventions, to adopt the normative rules of it. We have done also a lot of advocacy for the International Criminal Court, and I would say that a very innovative, once again, way of working to link the two questions for the protection of heritage is to bring to justice the perpetrators of the destruction of heritage. And you may know that there is a first such case. There already is a court decision of somebody who destroyed the mausoleums in Timbuktu. And this was, in fact, our initiative, UNESCO initiative. I sent the letter to Fatou Ben Souda, the chief prosecutor, after the destruction, asking her to explore the possibility of bringing to justice the perpetrators of such crimes. Because if it's written that it's a crime, it has to be prosecuted. We cannot allow impunity to be there. And I think that as long as Mali was ratifying, was a state party to the International Criminal Court, it was possible. Now we're working also with the International Criminal Court for Syria and Iraq and some other places. The problem is that neither of these countries had ratified the ICC, but as long as there are foreign fighters, the team of the chief prosecutor consider that there might be a case if we're working with them, once again, our two teams. So I think sometimes, of course, there is resistance, but when you are collective efforts, it can work.
Okay, I've got some more hands going up. There's take a hand here, front here. Yeah, and then a person here has got a hand up here. Like, yeah, that's you. Yeah. Okay, well, you know who you are. Mary, please, you could stand up, it'd be helpful as well, by the way, don't mind.
Thank you very much. You spoke very persuasively about resetting global governance at a right angle and talking about the grassroots and the importance of women and children and so on. But I wonder whether how you feel. It seems to me global governance is still regarded as an elite project. And we have huge political movements, not least in the UK, US and other countries, against elite political projects at the moment. And can the UN as a system, which itself is perhaps an elite system, can it bridge that gap that you describe between global governance and the grassroots? Or what else do you need to do?
Thank you very much. That's Mary Martin, who's working with us in Ideas on that. Colleague here from the University of California, Davis, I think. Welcome.
Thank you. So first of all, thank you for bringing up the importance of climate change and its importance in our world today. My question is geared towards the idea of climate justice. UNESCO has been working a great deal on implementing and fighting for the idea of climate justice. And I wanted to ask you, what have been the latest things being done by UNESCO to push that idea forward? Because it's unique in the sense that it's one of the only organizations in the UN that has been pushing it so much. I mean, with Paris that just happened, there wasn't as much of a fight for those who are being affected the most by climate change. So as the director of UNESCO, how have you personally wanted to push forward this idea of representing those that are the most affected by this phenomenon?
Thank you very much. Two questions.
Yes.
Madam Bogman.
Very good questions. And the first, of course, is difficult, but at the same time, I think it's extremely important because, as you said, we're seeing, I would say, in many parts of the world, that kind of a revolt, an acceptance, or a gap. As you said, it between some elites and the people. And I think, and this should be really, and it is already very much debated in many countries, we see that things that were not possible to happen some 10 years ago are happening nowadays. And even recently I was asked by a journalist whether the classical understanding of democratic representative system is over. And there are really, I would say, some basic questions that are in front of us. And this is very much relevant also, I think, to the United Nations and to the global governance. Now, what I think is maybe twofold. On one side, I think that the civil society and everything that emerges with the new ways of communicating and the new ways of exchanging ideas. If the United Nations or any government is not closer to these processes and knowing actually what is happening and what are the on the minds of people, it will fail, of course. And I want to link it also to the second question. I think on the climate change, it was relevant because there were the academia, there were civil society groups, NGOs and others who were pushing so strongly that could change the policies of governments. And we know that this is happening practically everywhere. Even those countries which we thought initially that will not come on board for the Paris Agreement are there because of the pressures of civil society groups. This is on one side. On the other side, I think the relevance is probably the answer. If the politics behind UNESCO, for example, what we are trying to do, if we are staying only in some ideas or some projects or which were relevant 10 or 15 years ago but not relevant nowadays, of course we will become obsolete and people will not trust us. It is the same, I think, with the wider United Nations system or with governments. And this is where I once again give example with UNESCO, but we are trying really to look at our core mandate, of course, but also to make governments and work with everybody in order to be relevant on what is happening nowadays. I will give you example with education, because education is a big part of what we are doing, and now that we are leading the global thinking behind education, and we have introduced very innovative, very new ideas, ideas of education for global citizenship, ideas about values, how we train, how we teach young people, ideas also to look at the open educational resources and how new technologies transform the process. We don't speak anymore about education, we speak about learning. If we didn't look from that perspective, I think we would have been not helpful and nobody would have paid attention to us. So I think relevance is probably the answer to many, many of these questions. Relevance to the concerns, relevance to what is happening, relevance to the, and the right response is indeed to find the right solutions. Now, on the climate change, I thank you for following what UNESCO has been doing, because indeed, apart from the fact that we have relevance to the climate change discussion through our science programs, biodiversity reserves that we have, through the natural heritage sites, because one third on the list of World Heritage are natural heritage sites, one of the biggest contributors to the thinking about climate change, and speaking about the parks in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or the Great Barrier Reef, or in Hawaii, the big protected area, which now President Obama made it even bigger, the biggest in the world protected area, the core is a UNESCO heritage site. So we, in terms of protection of nature, UNESCO is the standard setting. UNESCO is the big, I would say, normative venue of setting the normative side of the protected areas in the world. And we continue to work in this area. But the other side, of course, is the ethical side. And you spoke about justice. We call it ethics and climate change. And we are working very intensely now on the elaboration of a declaration on the ethics and climate change, which now is in the process of being, where we will look at the vulnerable, we're looking at the those who are suffering most, we're looking also at the, the responsibility, which not in the sense as it is in the climate change agreement, but in the ethical sense. And as long as I do believe nowadays more and more the questions about ethics and development are coming to the forefront, and this is not simply, I would say, a theoretical question. It is very much linked to the governance. It is very much linked to the global governance. It is about justice. If people are feeling injustice that is there, I think they cannot accept it anymore. And that is why our contribution to the climate change agreement, of course, we're working now for the COP22 in Marrakesh, and we will be doing many things. We have oceans, we have many other things. But this side about ethics and climate change is very much our contribution to this debate.
I think we've got time for one, maybe two more questions. If you could come forward and there's a... And if you could come forward, please, and there's a gentleman there wearing a... Yep, behind you. Okay, well... After you, and then you.
Education has a fundamental role for promoting sustainable development. As for the UNESCO Education Agenda 2013, the education for sustainable development has been put a lot of emphasis. What is UNESCO's maybe a new framework or maybe plan for promoting ESB in terms of teacher education, partner schools, and also for national national government policy and curriculum development. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, yeah? Morgan, LSU Game Institute. Ms. Boko, thank you for coming. There is already a speculation that you will become the next UN Deputy General Secretary. How will you accept?
Thank you very much. Okay, well.
The second question is
I think that's easy.
Speculation.
It's already been decided, unfortunately. They made the wrong choice.
But let me just, and by the way, I was very proud and honored to participate in the contest. I think it was a very good opportunity to present ideas, to participate, and in fact, I not only congratulated Antonio Guterres, I really think he will be an excellent Secretary General. We work together, we are friends, colleagues from the United Nations system, and I would say that I know him for the last 20 years, because when he was a Prime Minister, I was at that time, in 1994, 1995, 1996, I was at that time leading the Bulgaria. We began our relations with the European Union. For now, for us, it was a strategic project, and we took a lot from the experience of Portugal, and I know him for 20 years. So I think indeed that whatever capacities we will be working together and defending the same, I would say, values and principles. Now, for the ESG, I think it's...
Could you explain a bit more to the audience what ESD
is? Education for Sustainable Development.
Okay.
Education for Sustainable Development. In fact, if you look at the goal number 4 in the Agenda 2030, you will find the targets. There are 6 targets. And one of the targets is Education for Sustainable Development. Education for Sustainable Development, of course, is a broad concept. There was a United Nations Decade of Education for Sustainable Development that ended in 2014 with a very big and very important conference in Aichi Nagoya in Japan. Japan is one of the strongest promoters of this concept together with other countries. I may say that nowadays more than 100 countries already are on board. They're introducing in their education systems Education for Sustainable Development. And we see this, and we have adopted a plan of action, and we see this indeed on one side as education for the protection of the environment, education for climate change, but also education for human rights, education, as we say, for resilient societies, education for intercultural dialogue, everything that, as I said at the beginning, we put under the Education for Global Citizenship. I think this is a very innovative and new concept and extremely important. But in this particular case, when we speak about Education for Sustainable Development, we, I think, go very deeply into what is behind all the efforts about climate change or protection of the environment and protecting the planet broadly. Because unless we change our mentality, unless we change the way we consume, the way we behave, the way we produce, and to make, as we say, green societies, not just green economies, because economists are talking and governments a lot about green economies, and it's very legitimate, and I hope we can advance in that, but we need to create also green societies. And this is where Education for Sustainable Development comes, and this also starts on the benches of schools. So just yesterday, it's a good sequence of events. We had the second edition of an important UNESCO Japan Prize on Education for Sustainable Development, where we gave 3 prizes. We gave awards to 3 projects, one from Cameroon, another from Costa Rica, and the third one from the UK. It is the National Students' Union, I think it's called this way, where maybe some of you are members, which has a fantastic project of raising awareness about environment, about protecting the planet, about saving energy, and a lot of different details. And as I understood, already 100,000 students have been trained in different ways to adopt a new way of behavior, I would say daily behavior, in order to protect the environment and thus impact climate change. So I think it was a good event yesterday, and thank you for this question because it comes at the right time.
Okay, I think we're going to have to draw the proceedings to an end. They say that we live in the real world, but unless you have a vision, you'll never get anything done. And in some ways, there is something similar between the LSE and the UN. They were both created with a vision. A vision in 1895, when the school was created by Sidney Griffiths Webb and George Bernard Shaw, to build a better society and to change the world for the better. And in 1945, the UN was created, I think, for broadly speaking, very similar principles to make the world a better place, a more peaceful place, and the rest. And so thank you for bringing your vision of the world and a better world that we hope we will live in the next 25 years, because we've had a pretty tough and miserable time for the last 15. I'd also like to thank you all for coming along today, asking some great questions. Madam Bokova, thank you again. The only thing I would say is I'm going to vote for you next time if I have a vote. So maybe here today we're looking at the next Secretary General, but we'll have to wait and see. But please come back to the ERC. You're clearly one of us. We really would like to see you here again and bring back all the ideas and new thoughts you have on the UN. I want to put our hands together and say thank you very much indeed.